We want to reweave the lost connections in our world, those feelings of warmth and kinship we did have or might have. We want to reweave them. The gentle feelings that we can feel at times even for strangers, that knowledge beyond all argument that we are one, that we are indeed all in this together, flesh of one flesh and blood of one blood. Where do they come from, those gentle feelings? And how can we get them back? Sometimes we feel a more immediate and warmer compassion for a stray animal who we've never seen before than we can muster for the other human beings with whom we live. Why is that? Can it really be that familiarity breeds only contempt? It seems so sour a view of closeness, we vote no. And yes, some relationships should be ended when they can only become selfish or toxic, but something, over time, seems to breed at least indifference, and the indifference can kill the spirit of life itself left to fester. Something can seem to die even in the very relationships we most cherish. How did it happen? And can what seems wounded, injured, be brought back to full health? These questions run through our lives, our relationships, our jobs, our families, our nation, and our world. So much seems to have come undone. We want to reweave the lost connections in our world, those feelings of warmth and kinship we did have or might have. We want to reweave them. We will need all the help we can get. Let us seek that help within and among ourselves and our precious relationships with others. Amen. Much of this series of sermons on animal stories is really about looking for better stories to live out of. That means there's a religious background to what I'm doing. When the foundations of our Western religion were laid, when Yahweh, the main God, not the only God, but the main God of the ancient Hebrews, when Yahweh was created a few thousand years ago in their stories, He was created specifically to oppose all the nature deities of the Canaanite culture from which the Hebrews arose. The Canaanites saw us as absolutely embedded in nature because they were farmers. The Hebrews were sheep herders, and they created a religion that pretended we had no deep or necessary connection with nature at all, only with their God, who was created as a kind of tribal chief and who had to be obeyed. It's a very different sort of God. Yet we are profoundly children of nature. And that means that some of the biases in our religions have profoundly misidentified us and misled us, and that the real ground of our being is in our deep relationship with all other life on earth and with the earth itself, not with authoritative voices from on high or wishful poetry. That's why I think it's worth trying to take a more serious look at who we are and where we came from. Once I raise this. It's such an art. Life knows a lot. There are a lot of deep and clear patterns in life that can help show us who we are, what we need, what we love, and how we can live more fulfilled lives. They aren't hidden in creeds or churches. You don't have to hunt for them. They're not secrets. They're lying all over the place. We just have to look at them. So I want to look at some of the things that life seems to know today by looking at some animal stories. Today, some stories from monkeys and two apes who are our closest relatives, chimpanzees and bonobos, we are also their closest relatives, plus a few stories about dogs, elephants, bulls, and pigs. One of the most important things these stories show us is how much other animals can think like us, find the same kind of solution to their problems that we might find to them. Modern study of this field of animals' creative and inventive problem solving really only began around 1953, and it began because of a young monkey genius named Emo. Some Japanese researchers who were observing some Japanese macaque monkeys on the islands noticed that young Emo had solved a problem no one else in her troop had been able to figure out forever. The researchers gave these monkeys sweet potatoes, and the monkeys liked sweet potatoes, but they gave them sweet potatoes by throwing them on the beach. So the sweet potatoes are covered with dirt and sand and grit. How would you like eating sweet potatoes covered with dirt, sand, and grit? And what would you do about it? I can tell you what the monkeys did. Little Emo, at about 18 months old, took her sweet potatoes out into the ocean and washed them off in the ocean water. Now, this was an aha experience for these monkeys. 3 years later, this same little monkey genius solved another problem, much more difficult than sweet potatoes in the sand. And this was the problem that there was also a lot of rice lying on the beach. And how do you eat a rice and sand mixture? Well, little Emo just took handfuls of it and threw it in the ocean. The sand sank, and she ate the rice that floated. This was a little monkey genius. Before too long, all the monkeys in her troop were washing their potatoes and their rice, and now, more than 50 years later, long after Emo has died, it's part of monkey culture, and the monkeys teach their young to wash their sweet potatoes and separate their rice from the sand. Chimpanzees have done even more impressive things. In Africa, they've developed a hammer and anvil technique to break open very hard kula and pandan nuts. They'll carry these nuts 100 or several hundred yards to a special tree root or rock with an indentation in it and put the nut in the indentation, and then get a hammer stone, and they'll pick the stones out carefully for weight and shape and balance, or a very heavy hammer stick to crush the nut in order to get the nut meat inside. Now, they can get about 3,800 calories a day from these, so it's a significant source of food. It's also a skill, breaking these nuts, that can take a decade to learn how to do well. It can take 3 years even to learn how to do it adequately. Many of the humans who tried doing it failed completely to be able to be anywhere near as good as the chimpanzees at breaking open these nuts. Now children learn the skill from their parents and the chimpanzee troops, and it's become a part of chimpanzee culture. The human natives living in those areas also eat those nuts, and we've found their own hammer and anvil stations, much like the hammer and anvil stations of the chimpanzees. Theirs are in the village where the chimps don't go, and the chimps are in the forest where the people don't go. So it looks like the chimps and the humans thought alike and figured out the same kind of solution to the same problem, and we're always impressed when other animals think like we do. Now, we use chimps in the early part of our space program in ways many Americans may not even know of today, but it's worth knowing some of the stories. In the late 50s, the U.S. Air Force bought about 65 chimps from Africa, and they began training them to operate the controls inside the space capsules. If you remember, when the Russians sent up their first space capsules, they sent up dogs in them, and we were deciding to do one better than sending up dogs, and we'd send up chimps. They trained the young chimps through a reward and punishment system, where they would give them banana pellets for right answers and electric shocks to their feet for wrong answers. Oh, God, I can just see this in public schools now. Whatever the training sounds like, it worked spectacularly. It worked far better than anyone had thought. At one time, a chimp embarrassed a visiting congressman by making several thousand moves with only 20 errors. The congressman couldn't touch him. So in 1961, we sent two chimps into space, one at a time. The first life we sent into space was a chimp named Ham, who had learned to control the controls and get his banana pellet rewards up in space. Ham landed safely. And in November of 1961, we sent up our second chimp. The Atlas rocket took off with a chimp named Enos in it for a three-orbit trip, but problems came up as soon as he was in his first orbit. A gas line stuck open, spewing fuel out into space, but also sending the capsule into a dangerous wobble. So Enos had to correct the wobble in the spaceship and help bring the thing back to Earth. Now remember, this is a 5-year-old chimpanzee. This is about like sending a 3 or 4-year-old boy into space and expecting him to help correct the flight of an errant spaceship. Even worse, the reward and punishment system went haywire on the second orbit and began giving banana pellets for the wrong responses and electric shocks to the feet for the right responses. The rocket scientists assumed Enos would begin making wrong moves in order to get his banana pellets, and that was the end of the chimp and the experiment. Instead, Enos did the moves that he knew were right, even though he got a shock every time he did one. He returned safely to Earth. They removed him from the space capsule, which had a temperature of 106 degrees. One more orbit would have killed him. In post-flight tests, the scientists could barely match the chimp's in-flight performance, and none of them were receiving shocks, which doesn't seem fair to me. Thanks to the space exploits of our astrochimps, Ham and Enos, NASA made 250 safety and comfort modifications to improve Friendship 7, the spacecraft that would carry John Glenn around the Earth 3 times just 3 months later, in February 1962. Now, this is impressive, but as impressive as all this is, there are many more interesting things that other animals have to teach us about life. They're more about animals showing us what living things need, things that we also need, and which may be some of the most fundamental needs of all life, at least all animal life. Today, I want to talk about what life seems to know that it needs, what we can learn from the mind of life, to put it poetically. Next week, I'll focus more on the heart of life, some of the emotional dimensions of life that are clearly recognizable in us and in species separated from us by tens or hundreds of millions of years of evolution. Today, I want to share some animal stories that show us things we already know about ourselves. I hope there's no news in these 4 things. But we may not know how deep they run in the history of life or how broad they run across the animal spectrum. Life seems to need at least 4 things, at least the 4 we'll talk about this morning. It needs health or wholeness, and that's an interesting set of words because it's very close to one of the original meanings of the word salvation. Salvation comes from a Latin mean to save, but it also comes from the same root as the word salve. It's a kind of health, a kind of wholeness. Life seems to need that kind of health and wholeness, and the living creatures know it. I was exuberant. Life seems to need freedom and dignity. These sound pretty abstract to be applying to animals, but they're not. life seems to need, living things seem to need a safe place. And an amazing variety of them seem to have a very deep notion of fairness or justice and react very strongly when they don't get it. That may be one of the more surprising things to learn. First, life seeks health, wholeness, and salvation. We all know that dogs and cats will lick their wounds to clean and heal themselves and so on. But you may not have known about the evidence that chimpanzees in the jungle self-medicate. Some self-medication, herbal self-medication, is widespread in all sorts of animals, such as eating of clay, which works like kaopectate, or cats eating grass to aid their digestive system. But apes are also known to chew the bitter pith of certain plants which cure worm infestations and dysentery. Another discovery is that apes do what's called leaf swallowing. Chimpanzees tend to swallow these leaves in the morning before they forage for food. They don't chew them. They very carefully fold them all over with their teeth and tongue so that they can swallow them whole. And the leaves, it turns out, move through their systems like brooms, expelling parasites from their intestines. Leaf swallowing has been identified in a lot of chimpanzee population across Africa, involving over 30 different plant species. Now, some of the human tribes living in these areas use many of the same plants for many of the same medicinal purposes. And Western doctors are now studying the chimpanzee knowledge of natural plant remedies because they seem to have discovered medicinal properties in plants that we're not aware of. We seem to think a lot alike. A second thing life needs is freedom and dignity, to be respected. Nobody likes to be dissed. And feeling disrespected has led to a lot of fights and a lot of wars, but a whole lot of animals won't put up with it. If you've owned a dog, you know that they do not like to be laughed at. I've owned several. I've laughed at all of them because the response is just too good until finally you feel so guilty you just can't do it anymore. And you tease a dog and that dog will give you that and you know what it means. It means back off. I got teeth. A 19th century writer told a story about his terrier who loved to snap at flies on the window pane. You've seen dogs do this. One day the owner noticed that the dog wasn't actually catching any flies. And so he began to make fun of him, laughing and pointing at the flies. The dog promptly snapped at thin air, pretended to have caught a fly, and chewed the imaginary fly up real good. And then I suspect he snorted and walked away with his head held high. Nobody likes to be dissed. When I visited the Yerkes National Primate Research Center in Atlanta last November, I talked with a scientist named Sarah Brosnan, who's a postdoctoral student working there, who said that she could only do behavioral experiments with the chimpanzees when they were in the mood. And I said, "What's that mean?" And she's, "Well," she said, "they're smart." She said, "They know what you're trying to test, and if they're not in the mood, they'll sabotage your experiments." And I said, "What's that look like?" And she's, "Well, I just learned this a couple months ago." She said, "I've been running experiments with Rita, this female chimpanzee, on a match to object series of tests," and said, "Rita is very good at it, and she's an adolescent chimp, and she'd established a baseline of about 90%. She could always match about 90% of the objects. And she said, we were getting ready to move into more advanced things since we had a baseline. But she said, then Rita came into estrus, and she didn't want to leave the boys. And she said, you know, I hadn't thought about this as a variable when I started the test. But I thought, well, this is a new variable, so let's see what happens. So Sarah managed to separate Rita from all the boys and bring her back to the testing room Amazingly, Rita couldn't do better than 10% recognition. A few weeks later, when she was through with the boys, she immediately returned to her 90% recognition rate. How much like some teenagers does that sound? Now, I want to take one story that's much heavier and really more tragic, and that's one I just learned this week. The state of Vermont's motto is live free or die, and we all know Patrick Henry's famous battle cry, give me liberty or give me death. We may think this shows a life or death devotion to extremely abstract ideals like freedom and dignity that could only be true of humans, but it isn't so. Just this week, one of the scientists with whom I've been in email contact about animal stories sent me a story from a newspaper in Thailand about the training program for the elephants that they use to perform for tourists and to take people for elephant rides. The training is more brutal than I had wanted to know, though I'd understood that it was fairly brutal training. It is called crushing, meaning crushing the elephant spirit. And about half the elephants die during the training as they are chained in small pens and repeatedly abused. But some of the elephants they're now finding are committing suicide by standing on their own trunks and suffocating themselves rather than suffer through the abuse. I rode one of those elephants for about 3 hours and watched others perform while I was in Thailand several years ago, and this has forever changed some of the feel of that experience. Living things must have their dignity, their spirit, techniques that seek to crush it. And this would have to include a lot of breaking of horses. That's like crushing of elephants. Or the Calvinistic child-rearing programs designed to break a child's spirit. These may be deep crimes against the very spirit of life. A third thing living things need is a safe place. There's a Spanish word, carencia, that I first learned in the context of bullfighting. The carencia is that place in the ring where the bull feels most safe. It's a different place for each bull. If you go online, you can find that the word has now been used also as the name for all kinds of upscale resorts, offering patrons a safe, comfortable place. Whatever we call it, all life needs this kind of place, this carencia. Some species, including ours, make their own carencias. Both chimpanzees and bonobo apes build nests, as we do. Bonobos build nests in the trees for the night, but also they build them for resting or grooming or play in the daytime or just privacy. The nests represent a private area that no one else can enter without permission. For example, youngsters don't enter their mother's nest uninvited. They wait at the edge, requesting access by means of facial expressions and distress calls. Mothers use the sanctity of their nests to help wean their young by not giving them permission to enter. Other apes will make quick nests from a couple branches. It has to look pretty funny if you can see how quickly two branches can be turned into something called a nest that the ape sits inside of, to eat special foods so that other apes won't come take their food. And sometimes adult males will escape the threatening charge of another male by climbing up a tree and building very quickly a nest. In response, the charging males have been observed stopping at the base of the tree and moving away. In our species, we say our home is our castle, and breaking and entering into someone's nest or home is a crime. But the concept and the need for that kind of carencia seem to be as old and as deep as much of the life on earth. Sarah Brosnan, again, the woman at Yerkes in Atlanta, conducted a fairly famous experiment, a funny experiment, but fairly famous, with Capuchin monkeys. They are very cute little monkeys. And the experiment was conducted to find out whether the monkeys had some sense of fairness or justice. Some of the thrill of working with these animals, they say, is inventing the experiments. How do you test these things? And Sarah came up with a very clever experiment for Capuchins. Capuchins like cucumbers. That's good food for a Capuchin. But they really like grapes. There's nothing that touches a grape. Not even a banana touches a grape. So Sarah set up two cages adjacent to each other with a wire mesh between them and put a Capuchin in each cage, and she would bring a task to the first Capuchin monkey, and if the monkey did it well, she'd give him a cucumber. And the second monkey's watching this course, so then she gives the same task to the second monkey, and he's quicker because he just saw it done, and he does the task, and he gets a cucumber. Cool. You have an economic system set up now that's working fine. And she would try several other tasks the same way. Everything worked fine until she gave a new task to the first monkey, and when he did it, she gave him a grape. And this made the second monkey very excited. She gave the same task to the second monkey, and he did it right, but she only gave him a cucumber. In test after test after test, the monkey threw the cucumber on the ground and would have no part of it. It wasn't fair. There's another story from a Norwegian farmer who learned an important lesson from his big sow. Extremely fond of people, the pig liked to lie with her head on top of the metal railing around her pen when there were people in the barn. Those passing her would speak kindly to her and pat her head. One day the farmer had to repair a rotten board on the floor of her stall. The pig was curious and kept nudging and poking him and moving him out of the way as he was trying to work. He got annoyed, finally, and smacked her with a hammer. "I should not have done that," he said later. "For immediately, she took my whole thigh into her big mouth and locked it completely between her jaws, though she didn't bite. She probably only wanted to warn me not to do such a thing to her ever again. She found it intolerable that I would do something unkind to her." Now, this story shows a fairly sophisticated sensitivity on the part of the pig, at least. She had a sense of justice and of the consequences of breaking certain rules of behavior, but she also could make allowances for a slow but otherwise decent human being who could not be expected to have mastered all the points of fairness just yet. I'll close with one more story about how deeply embedded in us is this knowledge that life needs health, respect, freedom, dignity, and that playing fair with others sometimes asks that we help them and figure out how to help them. It's a story of a bonobo ape named Cooney, who one day caught a starling who had landed on her island in the Twycross, England Zoo. The bird seemed stunned, but otherwise okay, and the trainers tried to get the ape to give them the bird so she wouldn't hurt it or eat it. Instead, Cooney held the starling in her left hand, and then she went to the very tallest tree on the island, and she climbed all the way up to the top of the tallest tree. And holding on to the tree with her back hands or feet, she then carefully took the bird's wingtips in her hands and spread them out as though the bird were in flight, and then tossed them into the air. Evolution didn't teach her that. No one could have taught her that. It's an animal knowing what a completely different species needs or what she thinks it needs and trying to give the animal what it needs to return to health and to do it in a way that's dignified and respectful. Those lessons didn't come from religion. They came from life. I think this is a much bigger, broader, deeper, and more compassionate picture of the human condition within life than is presented by most religions, and perhaps especially by Western religions. Our minds look at and structure much of life in ways very similar to animals separated from us by millions or tens of millions of years. Yet here are all the parables we could need of noble, caring, gentle, and decent behavior. Something bigger and older than God is calling to us, and not with a harsh voice. It's the voice of life speaking through the mind of life, reminding us of who we are, what we're really like, how many living relatives we have, and what a rich world it could be if only we would remember our true heritage. Some of these stories are as profound as any religious parables I know. Think of how much about dignity, freedom, respect, and justice the pig and the bonobos seem to know intuitively. Then think about us. Do we really want to admit that we will settle for less?